And we are live. Welcome, folks, to episode 3720 of the Survival Podcast. And I guess it's a Bitcoin breakout episode, too. Yes, I tricked you. I didn't put the word Bitcoin in the title, but that's where we're going to end up today. Today's show is about the death of the 60-40 portfolio. And I think the 60-40 portfolio is something people either know about or they don't. I don't think there's a lot of, like, type knowledge of it. When it comes to conservative management of wealth, so we're talking pension funds, we're talking about what a financial advisor will move somebody into as they get within about 10 years or less of their eventual retirement, if that advisor is responsible as a human being anyway and doing their fiduciary responsibility, it's considered the gold standard conservative investment to continue to grow wealth with a hedge against downturns in the market. The idea being bonds are safe, except they're not, and they pay a fixed interest rate, which they don't actually do in some instances, in many instances actually. But then it's like this backstop. And at the same time, we have the majority of the wealth, the 60%, into select growth and income style conservative stocks. And that has been the gold standard for a very long time, but it really has been since, like, say, the 1980s till now. The problem is it's broken, and it's been broken for a while. People think that their stocks are doing well many times, and often they're not, because just because it went up in dollar value doesn't mean it kept pace with inflation, or your return that looks really good is actually okay. You know, it's in real numbers, maybe it's 2%. Which is better than losing money, but you thought you made 12% over a period, but you made 2 or 3% on, and you had to take the risk to get it. And these are just not the type of returns that work in the modern world. And many things based on the 60-40 formula are literally falling apart. Now, that 60-40 formula may not mean much to you if you're managing your own retirement, and you're 25 years old and you're invested in high-performing stocks only. You're taking risk with it because you have time. But trust me, the big chunks of wealth, we're talking the cash reserves of public corporations. We're talking public pension funds. We're talking sovereign wealth funds. We're talking university endowments today. We are not talking millions of dollars. We're talking hundreds of billions. We're talking trillions of dollars. That kind of money is not put all at risk. There's a conservative approach to it. And funny thing is, you know, it's becoming the most conservative yet high yielding investment in one form or another, whether it's direct or indirect exposure to it. Yeah, Bitcoin. I know for some of you, you're like, no way, man, that can't be. I heard it's going to zero. Peter Schiff said so or whatever. When I get done today, the only people who will continue to fight this recommendation that you put some of your wealth in Bitcoin will be people that just refuse to accept reality. We are past the entire debate at this point. What I put together for you guys today, you'll be able to get a free copy of this at the end of this live. If you're listening to it, you know, after the live stream is done, you can get it right now. Down in the video notes, there's a link. That link goes over to the audio version of the podcast. It goes out to all the podcast services like Apple Podcasts and Spotify and Pocket Casts and Podcasting 2.0 and Fountain FM and all of that stuff. And in the show notes, you'll find a link. Now, if you're watching live, you click the link now. As I always have to say, we're not done yet. It won't work. But this document is a breakdown of the current situation. It is written at a college level. In fact, I would say it's probably written at a PhD's level. And it's written that way because I didn't actually write it. I developed it, and then I used the Deep Think feature on Google Gemini's AI to actually write it. So I had about a 30-minute probing in-depth conversation today with Google Gemini. And once I got that all done, I gave it the objective of summing up the primary entities who will end up having to buy a lot of Bitcoin going forward, the problem that they're trying to solve, and how Bitcoin solves the problem for them. And more so, there is the concept in investing in economics between corporations, companies, entities of collusion. And when you hear the word collusion, you always think, you know, insider trading, breaking the law, things like that. There's collusion that's like we get together, me and all our buddies, and we're sitting around the table at the CFR or something like that, and this is what we're going to do. And they always get away with it anyway. But that, most of it anyway, technically would be illegal. There's ways to collude in a market like this that don't really violate any laws, because if you publicly disclose what you're going to do, then all the other people like you that compete with you and work with you and cooperate with you know what you're going to do. And it's not insider because it's out in the open. And everybody's starting to say the quiet part out loud. What are they saying? You'll find out very soon. Before we do that, let's go ahead and hear from our sponsors of the day. Sponsor of the day number one today is Start9 Private Servers. If you want to take back your tech, if you want to control your technology, if you want to be able to access your files from anywhere in the world with nobody ever deciding, yeah, you don't really need to do that anymore. If you want all your really important information available to you but not others, and you don't want to be in like a great big giant honeypot where if a hacker gets in, he gets like 10 million people's information. It's just you, and he has to go through all this military-grade encryption just to get to just you. You're not that important. And honestly, even finding somebody Start9 without knowing where it is and what its address is, very damn difficult. Then you have access to all your files from anywhere in the world over Tor, fully encrypted. But more, you can run your own Bitcoin node. You can run your own messaging service. You can run your own Lightning node, and you can do a ton more. And if you are capable of installing apps on a smartphone and using them, then you are capable of doing this. It is not that hard. I'd say the only thing that requires some real specialized knowledge, and it's not that much, is running a Lightning node. But it's not about the install and setup. It's more about the balancing of the liquidity and things like that. But you can run your own basic merchant account if you accept Bitcoin using a Start9 server, or you can just use it for all the other wonderful features that it has. And if you're an MSB member, you never, never, ever forget to use your discounts, because the discount on Start9 is big. 9% on a product like that is a great discount. Check them out. And you can get additional discount and sats back if you use the Fold card and stack the Fold Start9 gift card with the TSP MSB discount. Next up today, JM Bullion. Hey, this show is about Bitcoin, at least in part. Why are we talking about gold and silver? Because I'm not one of those guys. I'm not one of those arrogant maxis like real estate's a shit coin, gold is a shit coin, silver is a shit coin. Anything that isn't Bitcoin, say shut up. Just shut up. There is room for diversity within your investment portfolio. And I'm going to tell you that I think one of the other instruments that's going to fill the kind of role we're talking about today with Bitcoin is going to be gold and silver. And that means you might want to have some you can put your hands on. Now, why JM Bullion? Honest to God, about 2 minutes before I started this episode, I got an email from somebody asking me if I would accept a gold and silver sponsor under another name. And I told them, no, this is the guy I've been running with for like 12 years now. It's JM Bullion. They do a discount for the MSB. I can talk directly to the president. All your orders ship free. And again, you get that discount if you're an MSB member in the gold and silver space. I just don't know why you would honestly use anybody but them, given all that, including the loyalty of being a sponsor with us for 12 years. That's pretty incredible in the world of podcasting. All right, now let's get into this. Again, let's start off with just the typical 60-40 portfolio, what it was and why it made sense. We were in, especially from, you know, as we began to recover from the stagflation of the 70s, and we went into Ronald Reagan's Morning in America and a new way of things and refinancing the debt. And by 82, 83, we had kind of pulled out of the recession that we had been in for more than a decade. People didn't want to admit it was that long, but it was more than a decade. We were on about a 15-year recession by 1983, and we'd finally escaped it. And we went into this era of unprecedented growth. And with, you know, some notable corrections, it was still pretty much a nothing but up arc. We had a pretty bleak day in 1987, but that whole crisis lasted about 48 hours. It was so quick, most people didn't even get a chance to buy the dip, as we say. We had our dot-com bust, and we had our 2008 bust, and then we had our COVID bust. But overall, it has been pretty hard not to do well invested in, let's say, your top quality stocks. But inflation has eaten away at those returns, and it's been like, you know, inflation chasing it and then the gap closing across time to now you think the stock market's doing good, but when you really sanity check it against inflation and true buying power, not the CPI or CPI as they call it, you know, I call it the CPI because it is a lie. They voodoo the numbers. And when you really look at your purchasing power, the stock market, like if you're talking about like the S&P 500 or the Dow Jones Industrial Average or whatever, it really is doing as good as it seems like, because everything goes up in dollar value, because the dollar value goes down. That's the state that we're in today. Most things you purchase cost more than they used to, but does that mean you want to be invested in them? You see what I'm saying? So we've had that erosion play away. If you take out the group of stocks that we call the Mag 7 or the Magnificent 7, and you look at the remainder of the index there, it's not so impressive. On top of this, the issuance of bonds has been driven, the interest rate on bonds has been driven down, and the trading of bonds has become so frequent that bonds that we've thought of as safe investments are either not making enough money in returns to make money on, or they're actually losing money. So if you are trying to manage huge amounts of income and be somewhat conservative because you have a mandate to do so, and that's your tool, it just doesn't work anymore. And again, we're talking things like public pension funds. We're going to break these down one at a time in a minute, but imagine you're a pension fund manager, and you're a pension fund manager for, I don't know, the fire department of a major city that's losing money out of its ass. How do you manage to take all the money that's in that fund and kick out enough money out of it every year to pay all your retirement obligations and not have the fund dwindle down to nothing? The plan that used the 60-40 model was probably put in place by somebody about 1988 to 1992. And it wasn't designed to work today, because it can't work today. Nobody would put that plan together today, but it's legacy. Everybody's stuck with it. That's where we're at. Now, Trump just dropped an EO, and the Bitcoin maxis, like the people they would, because I consider myself a maxi, but the people really considered like toxic maxis, everything is to be hyped to the nth degree by these folks about how important it is. And this is important, but not for the reason that they think. What I'm about to tell you, I've not heard anybody say about this EO yet. Now, somebody may have said it. I'm saying I haven't heard it. What the executive order that was placed just last week said is that we need to explore and allow for alternative investments in 401ks. Now, these would be considered things like private equity, gold, Bitcoin, silver, other cryptocurrencies, basically all the other investments. And what the Twitter crowd, the X crowd was saying is, we just got open to $9 trillion. It's just shut up, stop. Actually, nothing's happened yet. Nothing's happened yet except guidance. But the guidance is critical. So will these plans like Fidelity, you know, et cetera, at all these people that administer these retirement plans all over the country, all these 401ks all over the place, will they allow these investments as laid out in that EO, which is pretty much everything in? And the answer is probably not. Probably not. There is not even a guarantee they will allow, let's say, the direct purchase of Bitcoin in. You know, they already can allow the purchase of something like IBIT, which is an ETF from BlackRock that holds Bitcoin, or GLD, which is an ETF that holds gold. Like, these things they can already leave in. What people do not understand about the importance of that executive order is it reverses government guidance from the past that created a massive amount of potential liability for plan administrators. That's the real magic. Now, if you're sitting there going, huh? What did he say? Let me make it clear. Under Biden, and even under Trump, because Trump was no fan of crypto or Bitcoin or any of this shit in his first term, the official federal government level guidance toward this stuff was, and again, we didn't even have the ETFs until very recently, don't do it. It's incredibly risky. Don't do it. So even if there was a way to do it, if the ETFs had come out a little bit earlier or something like that, if you are a plan administrator and you add that, right, we're not talking about a brokerage option here where the individual could do it themselves, but like they literally sit down and you know how when you do your 401k allocation, you're like 10% this, 25% that, 20, how much is that? Okay, yeah. And there's just like that list of funds there. If it just says IBIT or one of the other ETFs or GLD for gold or SLV for silver, if those are just in there, gold and silver were in this classification too. This is risky. You shouldn't do it. And if you do it, you should use extreme caution. So if you're a plan administrator, your goal is to not, above everything else, not to get fired, not to get sued, and not go to prison. Those are your top goals. I don't want to be, you know, malpractice, malfeasance, skirting what's legit, like tip, you know, kind of attracting a federal prosecutor or something. I don't want any of that shit. If you're that administrator, you're already making enough money. You don't really care. You just, as long as you don't get fired, don't get sued, and don't go to prison, you're good. You don't even care if you get fined. I mean, honestly, because the fund itself will pay the fine. When you have like this blinking red sign that says danger, 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 Will Robinson, danger, right? You're not so hip on doing this. The Trump EO didn't just open the door. It reversed that guidance. The guidance is now we should do this. And the further guidance is the government needs to explore and offer additional guidance on how to open it up even more into these funds. But again, now we have official federal guidance, and the people that these plan administrators are most concerned with the guidance of is the government first, and then the service to the customer second. Because that's how they stay out of jail. That's how they don't get sued, right? And that's the most important, and that's how they keep their job, because I did what I was supposed to do. Market went down, it doesn't matter, I'm supposed to invest in this class of asset. I did, it went down, but that's the class of asset I'm supposed to be invested in. You can't fire me. Got it? Okay. Now you have no real reason to hold it back. There's no reason anymore to not add one or several of the ETFs that meet these types of investments, or there's no reason not to have the brokerage option, because believe it or not, that's why so few people have that brokerage option, or that brokerage option is limited. So a lot of plans will have a brokerage option, but you can only use 10% of the funds in the brokerage window. A lot of that's about to change. Now, that's just your private retirement accounts. That's your 401ks or 401(3) if you're a teacher or what have you. But we're going to get deep into this today. We are going to start seeing, I believe, at the managed portfolio level, at the sovereign wealth level, et cetera, portfolios that look more like there's some gold and or silver in there. Maybe there's some real estate in there. There's direct Bitcoin exposure and indirect Bitcoin exposure. And what do I mean by direct and indirect? I would call, even though I know the maxis get really mad when you say this, owning an ETF direct Bitcoin exposure. You are directly participating in the market value of Bitcoin. That's what an ETF does. All the hate can go screw itself in the, you know, back up 10 feet and screw your own face, right? That's how I feel about anybody that wants to shit on that. Obviously, if you have money that you can do anything you want with and you want to buy Bitcoin with it, it has no limitations on it, direct purchase makes the most sense. But when you have captive funds that have to have a certain classification of investment, and now it's open where otherwise it isn't, go for it. Don't pay the penalties and take it out and all that stupid shit. But that's direct. Indirect exposure would be buying one of the Strategy B, or formerly known as MicroStrategy investments, something like STRK with an 8% dividend, but it's leveraging it Bitcoin. Or buying stock in a company that's a Bitcoin treasury company, or buying stock in a company that is directly related to the Bitcoin industry, like a mining firm or a hardware manufacturer or something like that. Those would all be indirect. And those are traditional stock investments, but they are a different type of investment from a mindset of why you chose it. So I think we're going to start seeing portfolios like that a great deal more, but we're going to see a lot of portfolios with very direct or only slightly indirect exposure to Bitcoin, which is Norway has more than doubled its exposure to Bitcoin this year as a sovereign wealth fund. Norway, the country. You know, for all the talk about El Salvador, you know, what El Salvador is doing, direct self-custody of Bitcoin, but it doesn't really matter if the money's actually in Bitcoin, the money's actually in Bitcoin. And so that's a huge thing that's happened as well. But let's break these down. These, what are these biggest chunks of money, these biggest walls of money? Where are they, and what are their, what is their problem, and how does Bitcoin fix the problem? So first is the public pension funds. Now, I don't mean what we just talked about, 401ks. I would call that private pension funds because you manage your 401k. Yes, your plan administrator says, here's the 10 funds you can pick from, and maybe if I really like you, I'll give you some portion of your own in a brokerage window. But you can go one way or another, effectively all cash. You can go all stocks. You can go all bonds. You choose how that works, and you individually oversee and manage your account. When I say public pension funds, I'm talking about, you know, the retirement fund for teachers in Chicago, the retirement fund for police officers in Chicago, the retirement fund for firefighters in Boston, Massachusetts. You got that? You see what I'm talking about? We're talking about public worker pension funds. And these folks are in a bad way. Everything I forecasted 15 years ago has come to happen. All these municipalities are now on the verge of total breakdown bankruptcy. The cities are coming apart. They're overrun with crime. They're not just not fixing it because, as the TV wants to tell you, they don't want to fix it. They can't. Now, are they doing less than they could be? Sure, but in the end, they don't have the resources. They're paying the salaries of workers, police officers, firefighters, EMTs, teachers, bureaucrats, et cetera, who haven't worked in 20 years. They're still on pension draw. And a lot of these pensions are pretty fat, too, with the benefits that you get. A lot of it is union-driven, government union-driven nonetheless. And these people are not reasonable. The ones still working and the ones that are no longer working. The fact that enough money's not coming in to meet the payout requirements and keep the pension running doesn't matter to them. I want what I want. You figure out. It's not my problem. You said you'd do it, and now we want more. Well, there's a, like that chain is starting to break. The problem they're trying to deal with here, the biggest problem they have is the same problem that governments have, like the United States government has, unfunded liabilities. In other words, you can look at how many people are retired, how much we have to pay them, how many people are going to retire, how many people are coming in, and our total revenue coming in to these funds, including revenue from things beyond the contributions to these pension funds, like the pieces of property tax and whatever from the government revenues that go in to help fund this. Because everything that these teachers and what have you earn is all taxpayer money anyway. So even if they're taking their money and funding it in, it still comes from the worker, but the worker gets their money from the government, and the government gets its money from tax. See how it works? That is, so they don't have enough money coming in to meet their obligations going out over the next 10 years. Like, not many of them, not even close. That break that I said was coming is here. It's happening now. They also have revenue decline. Revenue decline, meaning that a lot of these places, people are challenging the property assessments as far as with a tax obligation, and under the current market, they're winning. Judges are siding with the people. This building is not worth $1.3 million. It's worth $800,000, and that tax rate's getting adjusted down. And then you, compounding that problem, you have population decline. Cities like Los Angeles and Chicago, et cetera, are in economic decline because they're in population decline. And the people that are leaving are the mobile, high net worth individuals, right? The people that are poor, that are taking from the system, are stuck, right? So they're staying. But the people that anywhere from upper middle class to truly affluent and wealthy, they're the ones flying out. They're the reason when you look at the cost of a U-Haul from Los Angeles to Dallas, it's a lot more than the cost from Dallas to Los Angeles back. right? Because they know if you rent it one way from L.A. to Dallas, it's probably not coming back. But they need trucks back in L.A. to rent to people that are leaving, so they'll practically pay you to drive the thing to L.A. for them. It's about half if you look it up on U-Haul or Ryder or any of those sites. So they're dealing with that giant sucking sound, and channeling a little bit of Ross Perot, right? The giant sucking sound of the people leaving and the returns are insufficient and the outgoing payments are getting harder and harder to make. Sovereign wealth funds. Again, I just talked about how Norway has purchased or has increased its direct exposure to Bitcoin by over 200% this year. El Salvador, you know, their sovereign wealth fund is straight up Bitcoin. But more and more nation states and U.S. states have sovereign wealth funds. So other nations, too, maybe have provinces that are big enough and they manage their own sovereign wealth funds. Now, we're talking real money here. Now they have very similar problems though. First of all, if you're a sovereign as in a nation, you have fiat failure. Same problem everybody else does, but you have it at a bigger level. Now at least you can print more, but every time you do it, you make the problem worse. It's like trying to fight fire with fire, literally. I know, I'll throw gas on the fire, that'll put it out. So the more you print, the more the problem becomes a problem and the angrier your people get. So you can only run that so far. Then we've got the trade wars that are going on for many of these sovereign entities, and it's the uncertainty that's a big part of it. They don't really know how to plan and manage their economy going forward until these things are hammered out. Additionally, we have their pension obligations, just like the public pension funds. These larger nation states have federal obligations to these retirement plans, and they have unfunded liabilities in them. And again, U.S. states are in a similar place with public pension funds, but instead of being at the city-county level, they're at the state, lower S, level. Like Wisconsin has recently put Bitcoin exposure on their sovereign wealth fund. This is starting to happen. You're just not seeing it. The people involved in it don't really want to talk about it that much yet. If you want to know how I put all this together, I listen to everybody instead of just my favorite people. I listen to all the opinions, and when I add all the opinions together, you get a much clearer picture. I liken it to there was a religious documentary I watched one time, and I think it was they were asking all these different religious teachers about their view of God, and it was either a Buddhist or a Hindu that came up with this analogy. He said all of the religions of the world are looking out to the same God, right, the same overriding spirit. And each of them is looking through a window, and that's why they have their view of God. But if you were to look out all of the windows, you would have a better comprehensive view of what this spirit really is. It was something to that effect. And I don't know if that works for religion in reality, but the analogy works great for news and economics and things like that. The more information you amalgamate, the more pieces you have of the puzzle, the clearer a picture you can get of where we're going. That's where this is all coming from today. Next up on this list of entities is university endowments. Okay, university endowments. This is hundreds of billions of dollars sometimes in one college. But we've talked about the colleges. They have problems too, right? They have the enrollment cliff that's hitting right now. There are just less people coming out of high school, total number, body count is going down, and it's going to go down every year for at least the next 10 years before it even levels out. We already know this because we know how many people there are, right? If you're going to be applying to go to college in the next 10 years, you are already alive, right? Most people will probably go to college at like 18, 19, maybe 17 years of age, somewhere in there. So everybody that's going to go to college in the next 10 years is at least 7 years old. And most of them are somewhere between seven and people that will be applying to go next year because everybody going this year already applied. So it's between 7 and 17. We know exactly how many of those people there are. And we know that as you go down in age, there's less of them. So they have a customer acquisition problem. There's less people to acquire. Okay? Now, they've also, many of them are losing federal funds. And while some of the federal funding they're losing is this anti-DEI culture war fight with the Orange Man, in the end, the federal government is using that as a way to begin this process. Federal funds are being cut back to public education and college level university education because they need to be, because we're talking, the United States is a sovereign in itself. It has all the problems we just talked about with the last layer. Yeah. We're also dealing with declining enrollment of the remaining eligible. So not only are less units available to process into new students, right? Those are high school graduates, but the portion of those who are there that go on to college is in decline because the fascination and romantic nature of I'm going off to university is waning. More and more kids that are like 16, 17 coming into that age have older siblings that they've watched, and all they do is listen to their older sibling bitch about student debt and schlep coffee at Starbucks or something. And you know, their buddy's brother is out in the oil fields making 120 grand a year as a welder, and they're like, maybe I'm gonna go do something different. So we're getting more and more into this state where not only do we have less students available, but of what's available, less are going because there are alternatives. And the federal government just opened up the doors to the trade institutes. They've made a lot of things that were hard to do in the past easier to do as far as getting loans. They've made it, you know, more accessible to your educational accounts and things like that. 529s, that's what I was trying to think of. A lot of things that you couldn't use a 529 for 10 years ago, you can now. So there's more options. There's other options. Plus, people are seeing that, like, boot camps, self-directed learning, et cetera, will get a lot done for a lot less and do it a lot faster. So we're just in a straight-up decline revenue in for these universities, and now they have to make that endowment money do more without dwindling it down to zero. You got that? That's their problem. Okay, they all have this problem. The university endowments are in a real problem because they're in a direct decline spiral in the value of a degree. In other words, the value of what they sell has gone down while they've kept forcing the cost of it up. It's like building a car that's half the car that we built 10 years ago, but charging twice as much money for it. It's exactly what the colleges have done. Some of you are like, that's what the car companies have done too. No, they really haven't. No, they really haven't. The cars we have today are better than the old cars. They don't make them like that anymore. You see a lot less of them on the side of the road. Okay? I don't want to go into that too much, but that's one of those myths out there. Free markets don't work that way. If you have a choice, if you're not, you know, able to just tap into unlimited funds that somebody else has to pay back the loan against, like colleges do, you can't increase the cost of something that declines in value. They've run that out, though. They did it, and they can't do it anymore. Then we have what we call family offices. What are family offices? Family offices is an industry term, and it's really very high net worth families. Some of these might be names you know, but a lot of them are names you don't know. There's a lot of very high net worth, you know, several hundred million up to $1 billion family wealth funds out there. And you know, some of them are just people that were really successful in real estate. Some of them maybe they're high level surgeons, other professions, investment management, et cetera. There's a lot of money in our country that's unseen. We don't really know. When you drive through those super affluent neighborhoods and there's like 100 houses and they're all a couple $1 million plus and not California where it's retarded, right? Like, people live in those. People live in those, and unlike, you know, stupid shows like House Hunters, it's not a CSR and an independent musician that buys that freaking house. That's a lot of money. Their problem is poor stock performance, like we led off with. Underperforming bonds. They're just not getting what they want from that 60-40 mix anymore. Because, again, we're not talking about somebody trying to save up a couple $1 million and retire on. These people have millions. They're looking for enough income off what they have so they can live their life doing as they please. Even if they're actively working still, they want that wealth layer providing them everything that they want. And they've run it out too because of the declining, the money's broken. So even if your ROI looks good, your ROI is broken compared to where it was 10, 15 years ago. So they have that problem. They're concerned with generational wealth. Term we use in Bitcoin a lot, isn't it? They're concerned with generational wealth. These wealthy families, some of these wealthy families are in their third, fourth generation of having their wealth grow irrespective of their careers. And if their careers add to it, so much the better, but their wealth grows. They know that their grandchildren are set, and their grandchildren are supposed to know that their grandchildren are set. That's breaking. That generational wealth flow is beginning to fall apart for some of these people. They are highly familiar, though, with the concept of never sell your assets, borrow against them, and use the money to pay back the debt on the next round, or you only sell an asset when you're going to a higher level asset. They're the people that run that game. That's why they are the largest holders of real estate outside of like the giant real estate conglomerates. When you look at individuals and family level, small company level, small corporation level real estate holdings, these are the people that have it. Because it is the perfect vessel. Somebody else pays for it. It rents out and has a cash flow. It depreciates and reduces my tax footprint, and I borrow against it for tax-free income. Bitcoin does that even better. So it fits their keyhole. They know how that works. Okay. Then we have insurance companies. Insurance companies are locked as to what they can invest in. They just can't go out and buy anything they want. They might have a small, narrow window, kind of like your brokerage window in your 401k, where you can be a little bit of some risk asset over here. But they have been the king of the 60-40 portfolio. But the insurance company has to match premiums in to claims out and have a profit left over. And for all the shit they get, it's not exactly an easy business to be in. And once they're a large public corporation, they have earnings expectations to meet in the billions of dollars. And if they don't do that, then the market punishes them. So you say you want them to be ethical, but their ethical obligations are both to their policyholders and to their shareholders. And to the shareholder, they have to make enough money off of the policyholder to pay the shareholder. So that's their ethical dilemma. And for decades, a 60-40 portfolio based on their business model made that work. It's not broken yet, but it's actively falling apart, and they can see it. They require yields to meet their future obligations. They're limited to conservative investments required by law. And again, they can hedge that small bit of risk capital. But there are indirect exposures that these folks are going to be able to purchase now that double their ROI overnight. I'm saying fixed income instrument was 4%, 3.5%, 4%. Now it's 8-10%. And it fits the same requirement from a regulatory standpoint, and you can only do it with Bitcoin. And that's our friend Michael Saylor with, you know, like STRK, and we'll get into those in a bit. So now we have one more place to look, and it's the one that's gotten the most press so far, which is why I put it last. Public corporations. Public corporations are suffering from a lack of enthusiasm for being an owner in them anymore. I mean, why do you go public? Think about it. Why do you go public? It's a hassle. The amount of the cost of simply reporting is a huge hit to take on your revenue. The oversight, the privacy you give up, the regulations you become subject to that you were not in the past. You're taking the public's money. The federal government has an entire different view of what you can and cannot do, what you can and cannot say. If you're in a private company and you're working on a merger deal and that makes sense for you to move some equity around, you don't have to tell anybody. Right. It, other than what your charter says for the partners, you disclose to your own what that requirement is. When you are the head of a public company and you know that something bad is coming and you're dumping stock, if you don't report that, you can go to Club Fed. Even a billionaire can. why would you do this to yourself? Because you make a fuckload of money, to be blunt. That's why. Because then people buy pieces of your company, yet you keep controlling interest. And the more stock you can sell, the more money you can raise without actually doing anything. Right? So you only go public so that more investment money will go into your company, and you give up little pieces of your company, we call those shares of stock, in return for that. So what's the point of being a public company if the public ain't interested in owning you? Well, people are no, people are snapping to the Mag 7. There's literally, you know, ETFs and whatnot that basically just hold the Mag 7 instead of holding like the whole, you know, S&P 500 or whatever. And people are moving more toward that because that's where all the returns are. I'm telling you, if you take the Mag 7 out of its group and look at the group without it, it is not impressive. So they need to increase investor interest. Even the ones that are making lots of money, they're stuck in the cash is trash paradigm. As the money value continues to go down, it costs you money to hold money. You have to do something with the money. And your investors are like, what are you doing with the money? If I wanted to hold cash, why would I buy you? I mean, do you know one of the reasons that Google bought YouTube? This is I'm going to go way back into mental archives for this one. Google, at the time they bought, that's where they were called Alphabet. They were just Goog was their trading ticket, their trading symbol. The FTC started looking at Google, and Google had so much cash on hand, they said, maybe you're not a stock, maybe you're a mutual fund. You have too much capital. You don't have it in real estate. You don't have it leveraged in any way. So an investor is just buying in the cash, which they could just hold themselves. So you got to do something with your cash. So Google's like, oh, buy this YouTube thing. That was really the genesis of it. And then they were smart, unlike when Yahoo bought broadcast.com. Google was smart when they bought YouTube, and they did something. They made it into a juggernaut. You know, YouTube might save their bacon right now because search is dwindling due to AI. And they are in the game with Gemini, but I think that the AI market from a standpoint of revenue will never really be for one company because all these AIs do different things, what search was for Google. So without YouTube, Google could really be in a bad way, or Alphabet could really be in a bad way right now. But all these other corporations are stuck with this money. That sounds like a great problem to have, but not when your business is whatever their business is and attracting shareholders. Then cash alone is not good. In fact, sophisticated investment managers will look and go, this company has too much cash not at work. Enter in the Bitcoin treasury company. Surplus financial capital is swept into Bitcoin, and we start looking at the company as to how many Satoshis are there per share. And that's and it's happened with companies of all sizes. Big companies with huge holdings like MasterLink, now Strategy, little companies like Steak and Shake, GameStop, et cetera. And so those companies are now raking in the Bitcoin. What does this do for us? How does Bitcoin fix their problems, though? We just laid out all the problems they have. Well, there's three key things in this. And we've hit on them as we went through, but let's recap them as to why all these entities can solve at least part of their problem through leverage with Bitcoin. One is that it's publicly auditable. This is one of those things, like there's a lot of things at Bitcoin people say, well, this and that, you go, that's a feature, not a bug. There was a lot of discussion on the Bitcoin Talk forum in the very early days when Satoshi was still around and doing all of the coding, well, most of the coding, people like Hal and some others were contributing to pieces and parts. But Satoshi was definitely the lead dog in charge. And this concept of create, and it could have been done. Everybody that was involved in the early coding realized we can make this a privacy coin. We can make this where it cannot be traced at all. The decision was made not to because these were forward-thinking people. There is this mindset now. There was a lot of people that jumped into Bitcoin and I would call the mid-game, right? This was after those first few years. And they got involved, and most of them were anarcho-libertarians. They started spending it. They started, you know, John Bush got a bus and drove it all around the country and lived off Bitcoin. Bitcoin that was given to him, and then he had to figure out how to spend it to provide for their housing and their food and their travel. And it was great that people did that. But somewhere in this, all of these people came up with this idea that the purpose of Bitcoin was to end the Fed and compete with the government. That was not the purpose of Bitcoin. Now, Bitcoin may very well end the Fed. Bitcoin, in many ways, if people say that the stablecoins are a Trojan horse backdoor to a CBDC, Bitcoin is becoming a Trojan horse to end the Fed eventually. We're not going to slay that monster today. Maybe that's something we'll talk about in the future, okay? But this idea that we could make it a privacy coin, like a Monero or a private pirate chain or a Zcash or something like that, what was decided is if this really gains adoption, being able to, if a company says we have, $5 million worth of Bitcoin, do you? Prove it. Prove it. And if they can't prove it and they refuse to prove it, then, you know, do they have enough good faith with their market? Because, like, Strategy doesn't want to disclose these addresses. And we'll see how long that works for them. Now, I personally believe they have their money. I think the other thing is, just because you can't audit it doesn't mean that the federal auditors can't audit it. And what I mean by that is there are people whose job in the federal government is to do nothing but put people in jail and fine people. They're called prosecutors. And they work for places like the SEC, right, and the FEC and other organizations. And when a company says in a public statement, we have added X amount, you may not know that address, but that federal auditor does. And so we are now talking about an investment space that can be audited. And in fact, the entire space, all the Bitcoin, every Bitcoin in the world is audited once every 10 minutes. Nothing else has that. There's nothing like, do you really know how much gold there is? Do you really? Above ground and refined. We have estimates. We don't really know. Can we be sure that an ETF that says it holds gold is actually holding physical gold? No. Because in some instances, they're holding something that is a claim on gold. That might be a claim on somebody else's claim on gold. With Bitcoin ETFs, this is not possible. The way it was done by the government, it requires a one-to-one reserve period, and that is immediately auditable. So you're talking about an investment class that anybody can put together, any investment vehicle, and whatever they claim about Bitcoin, they can prove what they have. This is something we've not had in especially alternative investments, private equity, et cetera, in the past. We've never had that. Next, it's pristine collateral. What I mean by pristine collateral is it doesn't age like a building. You can have a beautiful house, and you may not, you know, maybe when you bought it, the inspector missed it, and there was a flaw in the foundation, and 5 years after you buy it, the whole thing's ready to fall down. A house can be hit by a hurricane or a tornado or what have you. So when you put up real estate as collateral, you have to put up equivalent insurance with it, and as you've collateralized the real estate, you've also collateralized the insurance claim. Okay, and then that it just leads to a whole rash of concern by lenders using these things as collateral. They always did it because it's the best thing they have. With Bitcoin, a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin is a Bitcoin. 100 million Satoshis is 100 million Satoshis. It doesn't matter. It can be locked up in a smart contract, collateralizing a loan. And if the obligations of the loan are failed to be met, it's simply taken in enough to cover the differential. It can be liquidated because the depth of liquidity is there. And the creditor can get their money back instantly, avoiding a cascading failure effect. So all of these people that manage all of this money are smart people, even though you don't think they are because, well, obviously they must be idiots. That's just how we think, right? Yeah, we're smarter than they are, but they live in their houses on, you know, the beautiful river inlet or whatever, and we don't. Maybe they're all smart enough to understand what I'm telling you. They've been very resistant to it because it defies what they know, but reality's setting in. And they understand the collateral, and then there is the possibility of indirect exposure. STRK, which is a Strategy B product, is an 8% dividend. STRD is a 10% dividend. You've got Bitcoin treasury companies, et cetera. So there is a way now to gain exposure for all of these entities with as much money as they want. Because the ones that can't go direct can go indirect or ETF or what have you. So the door's wide open. And the federal guidance just changed. I mean, that happened last week. And everybody's talking about it opens the 401ks. And they're not understanding that the guidance, the language used by the federal government to the fund managers completely changed 180 degrees. It's all coming. This is going to lead to what I call the biggest ape in history. And the supply can only handle so much, where the only way to go then is increase the price. There's just only so much there. First of all, there's this debt recycle strategy. It's going to create it. Economic loop, right? An economic loop with a supply lock. And what I mean by that is there's only 21 million Bitcoin. The company, you know, it's not Bitcoin Inc. can't decide, hey, we're going to issue another 5 million Bitcoin because we want to sell it to people and make money. That's Ripple can do that, not Bitcoin. Right? Like they just issued, we issued it all, but we let it out. It's the same difference, right? You can't do that with Bitcoin. And so that means that that supply lock really is locked. The thing that keeps it trading and keeps the price from going too parabolic is that when somebody needs money and they're holding Bitcoin and they have to buy something, they either spend the Bitcoin, which is in effect selling it, or they sell it for cash and they cash out and they go do something with it. I want to buy a house, whatever. We have now introduced Bitcoin lending, and the terms are getting good. Are they perfect yet? No, but they're really good, especially against the appreciating nature of the asset. And that puts people that have lots of money into a position of, I can have my cash flow and not liquidate my asset. Do you know what rich people do when you give them that option? They take it. That is what's propped up real estate and driven real estate prices beyond what property is actually worth for the last 70 years. That's what did it. The ability to leverage the, in fact, for the last 700 years, really. Rich people have been leveraging real estate for as long as real estate's worked anything close to the way it does today. So again, these are smart people. They know how to do this. And so any of them that are now able to pick up Bitcoin directly will be able to participate in this loop, right? And that tells us something else. Why is there a 21 Capital? Why is Jack Mallers and Strike merging with Cantor Fitzgerald and bringing in Tether as a strategic partner? He's not doing it so he can loan money to me and you. You understand that? It's just not, because he already can. Strike already does this. They're not even doing it so they can do it with just high net worth individuals. They're doing it to serve these people we're talking about. Sovereign wealth funds, major corporations, pension funds. These people are going to want to take out loans for billions of dollars per cycle. And this new, you know, 21 Capital is happy to take a riff off of those kinds of loans of 3, 4, 5, 6%. They're happy to. And they've set things up where the money can be enabled and put into work way quicker than in the past, because it would work like this. This whatever entity, doesn't matter what kind of entity it is, we need $1 billion put to work. It could be a company that wants to start building something, hiring people. It could be a pension fund that wants to make its payments for the year, right? Could be anything. And if they have assets, they can take out debt. It's doable. But under this new paradigm with companies like 21 Capital, and I personally think there'll be more set up like this. I think Strategy may go into this model too eventually, though they seem to have been happy to carve out their niche and let 21 carve out their niche. But it would work like this. We need $1 billion. Okay, well, you need $1.25 billion worth of Bitcoin in a smart contract. 10 minutes later, there it is. It doesn't matter where the financing company is and where the operating entity is. It's global. It's borderless. It's permissionless, and there's almost no fees to move the money. Boom. Tether or a U.S. bank-issued stablecoin, maybe from Cantor Fitzgerald. 1 minute later, the money's there. 11 minutes. 11 minutes, and you just loaned $1 billion, and you make the fee off loaning $1 billion, and you can't lose. You can't lose because if Bitcoin falls, the borrower has to put more Bitcoin up in collateral, or the loan gets liquidated and you have a pristine asset that you can liquidate to recover your loss. Think about that. There's only one reason these companies are being built. It's to service this debt cycle. That's why they're doing it. And I know we think of debt as bad, but there are different types of debt. And borrowing against an appreciating asset at less than the asset appreciates at is good debt. That's fantastic debt. And again, you don't even have to worry about servicing the debt if you do this right. Again, these are all people that can work a spreadsheet and build a financial model. Because the way you do it, to make it real, let's say you were going to need $100,000 to put it like a number we can get our head around. And your interest payments over the first year are $9,500. You borrow $110,000. You take $10,000 and you put it into an account and you set it up to auto pay the and service the debt. Now you have $100,000 and you go live for a year of your retirement on it, or you build a new division in your company with it. And the worst thing that happens if you fail is you lose your Bitcoin, which is the same thing that would have happened if you sold your Bitcoin, okay, and paid for it out of pocket. It's a non-lose situation if you manage it right and you stay conservative with your loan to value. Because if I said I'm going to take 3% of my Bitcoin and sell it to start a business, most people would say, okay, that makes sense. But then you tell them I'm going to take 3% of my Bitcoin and use it as collateral to borrow money to build a business, then they say it doesn't make sense. One, I preserved my capital asset. The other one, I did not. And if I fail in my endeavor, I'm back to where I would have been anyway. Are you starting to see how this, and there it is, there's no income tax on a loan. And there's also no income tax if I fail the loan and the collateral is taken by my intermediary. So I'm ahead just by not paying tax. If I needed the money, okay, to start the business and I sold it, I'd have to sell more than the overage to cover the interest for that term of the loan. I would have to probably sell more like 25% more than I needed to cover the tax obligation that I have. You see how that works? Like if you are a sophisticated money manager, you're not taking option B, you're taking option A here. Which again, that means more and more of this Bitcoin that goes into the hands of these corporations goes into a lock and it becomes ineligible. You will never buy it. The person that holds it will never sell it. There's no reason to sell it. It goes up, you know, a 5-year compounded rate at about 50% per annum. Cut it in half to 25%. If I can borrow against it at 6%, I'm never fucking selling it because I'd have to be an idiot to sell it because I can do that forever. As long as I build a model that reflects reality, I can do that forever. At least till I die, until my kids die. Maybe it's my grandkids' problem at some point, and they have to figure it out when the world changes again. People think in quarters. If you can get out 2-3 generations, it's game over. Okay? And again, these companies are going to legally collude through public statements and disclosures. Do you know that Harvard University just bought $117 million worth of Bitcoin? Now, they did it by buying IBIT because they couldn't buy Bitcoin directly. This is what we were talking about with walls of money. They bought $117 million worth of Bitcoin. You know what's ironic about that? They bought it when Bitcoin was trading at, like it was this morning anyway, $118,000 in Bitcoin. In 2018, Harvard said, put out an official public statement. Harvard University put out a public statement, their opinion on Bitcoin. This is what they said. I shit you not. Bitcoin is more likely to go to $100 than $100,000. 7 years later, they paid $118,000 a coin for it. But again, they publicly disclosed, we just took $117 million worth of endowment money and bought IBIT. You know what that says? Hey, Yale, I know we have a rivalry. Hey, Princeton, I know we have a rivalry. But, you know, if you guys do this too, there's only so much out there. By the way, did you know you can borrow against it to fund your next new wing or something? Because you're not going to have enough tuition to do it with. And if you get 10 public universities colluding publicly and in the open. But it's not just them. You don't think that every major public corporation right now is watching what's happening? And even the ones that have said, no, we're not going to do it yet, are going, maybe we really. And how many do it before everybody does it? You understand that here's the groups I gave you today. Public pension funds, sovereign wealth funds, university endowments, family offices, insurance companies, and public corporations. Any one of those individual groups of entities can break the supply by itself. All of them are going to compete for it. They're not going to have a choice. They're going to have to do this because the more people do it, the harder it becomes to do. And as it becomes harder to do, the more you fall behind your competitors. I'm going to put a prediction out here. Other than a sovereign entity like a national government, it is highly unlikely that any private entity, any corporation, any endowment fund, anything like that, will ever catch up to Strategy. They have about 600 plus thousand Bitcoin, not $600,000, 600,000 Bitcoin at 118 grand a pop. Now you decide you're Jack Maulers, and I mean, they're going to do well. 21's going to do well. You want to catch him? Do you know what happens to the price as you try to catch him? And he can issue more debt and borrow more against what he has and buy more faster than you can because he has a bigger chunk to start with. But that only gets more true every day. Every day, some small publicly traded company says, yeah, we're going to buy 1,400 Bitcoin just to get started. It actually gets harder for an Apple to get where they need to be to have enough of a leverage point. And eventually, the gloves come off. And I think right now, everybody's kind of like in a Mexican standoff. Look at who's going to go first. But somebody already went first. But yeah, but what about the rest of us? And I do believe the United States federal government is going to have their sovereign wealth fund backed by Bitcoin. And I think the play there may very well be revaluing the gold at Fort Knox, because that would be revenue neutral. In other words, hey, the gold is actually worth, because we're still pegged. We're still pegged. We don't value our gold at Fort Knox at its current market value. All they got, it's an accounting change. I think that shoe is going to drop. It may not drop until 26. I don't know exactly what's going on there, but something's going on with this. There is enough peripheral information, and not just by retards like me on YouTube. Like people in the know, there's enough rumbling around there that's at least a possibility. But if you have any, let's say, G20 nation really buy significant amount of Bitcoin and begin to actually accumulate it, if you have any central banks do it, it's over. Then everybody has to do it. And if we do it, everybody really has to do it. Where the U.S. goes, in the end, everybody goes. No matter how much they complain about us, no matter how much they talk shit, just like the trade deals, everybody kisses the orange ass and the orange ring in the end. Now, we'll do this and we'll do that, and can we please have a meeting? I mean, isn't that what's happened with everybody? The EU, we're not doing shit. We're going to do this, and Trump's a dictator, blah. And then, what's her name? Ursula comes up, you know, just kisses the orange ass. Let's Trump throw over his knee and spank her and send her back on her way. We got everything that you could have possibly wanted. The deal we got from the EU was so good that the Democrats were mad that it was too good and we're taking advantage of the EU. That tells you something. So they are going to, Texas Plant Company says, I ain't kissing no orange ass, but they will. The global players will. So when the U.S. takes on a monetary instrument like Bitcoin, and we will, they will too. And then it's over. This front run's only going to last so long. right? And I know I'm going to have some retard show up in the comments here going, you're only saying that so Bitcoin will go up and you'll make more money. Guys, we're talking about entities here that measure their money in billions and trillions of dollars. Your little freaking $50 buy on Coinbase is good for you. It isn't good for me. It doesn't help me. I don't care. I want you to DCA every day because I want you to do it for yourself. Nothing I said, if everybody listening to me and everybody that will listen to me, if everybody that will listen to this podcast, which is way bigger in audio than it is in video, huge difference. It's roughly 50 to 1 over the next week. If everybody listening to this podcast over the next week all went out and bought $10,000 worth of Bitcoin, it wouldn't move the needle on price. I have no personal motivation for saying that. I'm sorry, I don't, other than I do care about you. But these entities are legally colluding right now. They're all saying what they're going to do out loud. The president of the United States had his company buy $2 billion worth of Bitcoin. The president of the United States, who is a billionaire, who loves to make money, who measures all success in the forms of how much money he made, had his own company, but it was a blind decision. Yeah, sure it was, right? Buy $2 billion worth of Bitcoin. And you have Democrats going, oh, look, they're cheating because now he's going to do things. It's not cheating because it's not insider, because you saw it happen, because it's disclosed, because you know. How many giant entities need to say, this is the game we're going to play, before you stop pretending you don't know what you know? Because that's where we're at now. Instead of what people don't know, it's people pretending not to know what they do know because they have resistance to this idea. All right, so what do we need to do, though? Because all these entities are coming. And the little guy is going to get squeezed tighter and tighter and tighter. Now, I'm going to tell you, I think 10 years from now, a person who's just getting started in the working world will still be in a good place investing in a daily or monthly investment in Bitcoin. Bitcoin will be the money of the future. It will be where you want to hold the majority of your wealth. But there's so many people that are wishing it was 2010 and you could go buy Bitcoin for a dollar or some shit. Your opportunity is better now, but for how much longer? And so we do need to restore retail interest in Bitcoin. If we care about the people that will own it, if we don't want the rich to have all of it. And here's what I think we need to do about this. Number one, I know it's very impressive that Bitcoin's 118 grand or 114 grand or whatever it is, and I'll check right now because I don't know when it moves around, and it's no, that's the ETFs. Right here is my control board. Bitcoin, as I speak, is 119,440. But there is a mindset that people have, a unit bias that people have, and it's very detrimental to themselves, and we need to stop reinforcing their bad mental math. That's 119,000. It can't go to, you know, even if it goes to 200,000, I don't make that much money. Well, if you're thinking about making money and being rich in the next year, yeah, it's probably not going to happen. The people will get rich on Bitcoin in the next year are already rich. They're going to get richer. And the amount of money they can make will be a lot of money. The more you have, the more it matters when it goes up 10% or 20% or 50% over a year, or like it has in the last 12 months, over 100%. Right? 100% on 500 bucks is 500 bucks. 100% on 500,000 is another 500,000. Now you're looking at $1 million, right? You got real money. But we need to stop using that big number. That big number is actually scaring people away. It really is. We need to start pointing out to people that, you know, you can buy about 1,000 sats for a dollar. And that's not going to be that way for long. There's been talk about creating an incremental unit, like a bit. You can buy a bit, and a bit is 1,000 or whatever it is. I don't even know, or 5,000 or whatever. But we just need to be pointing out to people that, like, you can invest $5 a day in Bitcoin. You can invest $100 a month in Bitcoin. Because there are still people, believe it or not, that really think they can't buy Bitcoin unless they have enough to buy one Bitcoin. If that were true, nobody would be in Bitcoin really by now, because there's only enough Bitcoin for a very small fraction of the world to own one. Less than 1% of the world can own Bitcoin. It's a ridiculously low number. You can't even have every millionaire in the United States own one Bitcoin. So if you're a whole coiner, you're already, you know, you're already set up to be generationally in the top 1% of wealth in the world, whether you realize it or not yet. And that's still a goal you can achieve. Is it easy? No. Is it going to get easier? Probably not. Probably not. There was a time it wasn't even really that hard. You know, with Bitcoin, Bitcoin flirted and farted around at about $10,000 for several years, you know, down to 3, up to 15, down to 7, up to 10, you know, like, and then it went all the way, ran all the way up to like 70 grand, and it came all the way down to like 15,000, 14,000 and change, right? And that's when I said it will never get easier than it is right now to stack sats. I did a whole show that saying it, that was the case. I said this is the accumulation trough in ACT today, and many of you did. ACT now. You still have the ability to become a whole coiner. If it was easy, everybody would do it. And you know you want to be one, even if you're still trying to convince yourself that you don't. So even if you fail, fail up. I think that like the new goal for people is going to be something like 0.1 Bitcoin. And that at least will be your first goal. And like a life goal might end up being 0.25. Not so far into the future. Not yeah. 0.25 is $1 million when Bitcoin hits $4 million. So that's not possible. It's going up forever, Laura. Forever. Forever. How long is the only question, not if. Believe what you want. We need to push our HR Karens. Now, I don't have an HR Karen because I don't work for a company. But if you do, I mean, you and your buds at work should be asking Karen every day, when are we getting IBIT? When are we getting a brokerage window? Hey, did you see the new guidance? Oh, I know you can't do all of it yet, but you know what you could do? You could get us a Bitcoin ETF. Where's our Bitcoin ETF, Karen? Where's our Bitcoin ETF, Karen? Hey, Karen! I haven't talked to you about this since yesterday. You say you were trying to hear it, but I gave you a day off. Where's our Bitcoin ETF? The biggest reason that people aren't buying Bitcoin right now is the place that they invest is their employer-sponsored plan, and they can't do it. I'm telling you, the vast majority of people out there would put, I don't know, 5% at least. That is, again, that's another $1 trillion. That's another, you know, one third of the market cap. Easy, just in 401ks. If every 401k had access to an ETF, if that's all that it was. So we need to push for that. We need to teach the way of the Bitcoin, DCA every day. I wish, as switched on as I was to this, as much as I talked about it, as much of my wealth as I put into Bitcoin, I stumbled on something, honestly, last year, just a year ago. I stumbled on a philosophy, and that philosophy was simple, and I'd already been doing it for a couple of years because of things like Fountain and Podcasting 2.0 and getting rewards with Fold and all, but I wasn't consciously doing it. And that was a very simple, I mean, this is the formula. End every day with more sats than you started with. That's it. And if you DCA every day, that happens. And all you have to do, because people are like, I can't afford to do it every day. You can buy a dollar a day. You can find a dollar a day. I don't want to hear it. You can go pick up soda cans and make a dollar a day, right? And most people would say, I can't afford it. But you can say, well, you can afford $100 a month. You know, can you do $150 a month? Yeah, I can do $100. Okay, that's $5 a day. Roughly. Take your monthly contribution, divide it by 30, round it off. There's some months have 31 and February 28, whatever. Just divide it by 30 and make that your daily DCA. Throw money into your brokerage account, you know, your Strike account, your River account, your Swan account, whatever it is, and set up a daily buy. Robinhood, whatever. Desert Ranger says, I DCA at $50 a day. Good for you, man. How old are you? If you're actually listening while you're typing, like, what's your age? I know some people don't want to do that. My wife said she read $10 a day for the last 10 years is $7 million. Isn't that interesting? If you invested $10 a day for the last 10 years, you'd have $7 million. Okay, Desert's 50 years old. That's good, then. That's good. I was hoping you were going to tell me something like you're 25, man. I was going to be so proud of you. Texas Plant Company's 30X. 38, 30X, Desert Ranger says Gen X all the way. Yeah, I got it. Jacob, $10 a day at age 30. Yeah, you're going to be all right, young man. But You'll probably be a millionaire by the time you're 40. If you're doing other things. I don't know if Bitcoin will get you there alone at that rate, but you'll do well for yourself because you're thinking this 5%. Jacob says I do 5% of my take home pay. Good. Texas Blank Company, I'm waiting for Bitcoin to make me look smart. 200K is in a genius. Okay. Okay. But this is the way. These, for the average person, these small amounts, and you're going to actually have no problems when the price goes down. People, this is the beauty of the more sats every day philosophy. I wake up and Bitcoin went up a bunch. So I look at my balance and I'm happy, right? I wake up and Bitcoin went down 10% overnight because some bad news came out. And I look at my purchase and there's an extra 5,000 sats in it and I'm happy. And something is happening because of Bitcoin with everyday people like we're talking about now, not these giant corporations and entities that the show's about, the reason it's going to go up. But something has been happening for a long time, and I would say in earnest for about the last 7 years, like post-block wars, there was something that began to happen with Bitcoin plebs, new people of Bitcoin. Saving. Early adopters like myself, one of the reasons we don't have as much as people think we do is because we bought stuff. We went in with the idea of the anarcho-libertarian viewpoint. This is private money. It's outside of the government. If we spend it, it'll speed up adoption. And then the government came in and imposed a tax policy on it and shit the bed on that. And then post-block wars, once we cleared the air, and I know they surface every once in a while, but they're just clowns and only idiots listen to them, of Roger Ver and Craig Wright and those people. Once we got kind of past them, the new people into Bitcoin who never saw that old world, that's kind of your dividing point there, because that's when the tax guidance came in all too. Well, they are saving more than investing. They're saving. They're seeing Bitcoin as a battery. And that leads to this philosophy of end the day with more every day. And I want you to think about something. If I tell you end every day with more sats than you started and you will have a great future, you might be like, nah, Jack, same thing, ain't going to come to zero, whatever. What if I said the same formula was end every day with more dollars than you started? Well, you're like, well, that makes sense. Well, what's a better form of money? A fixed, electronically enforced, programmable form of money that cannot be manipulated, that can be audited every 10 minutes, or fiat? So if saving so that you have more dollars every day than you started with would work, saving a better form of money should work as well. These are the conversations we need to be having with the unindoctrinated, the new people in. Don't worry about 118 grand. Don't worry about $1 million. Don't worry about getting super rich overnight. Worry about investing in Bitcoin the way that your grandfather invested in stocks, right? It's not the same as a stock. That's not what I'm saying. But the approach was a little bit every paycheck, and by the time you're ready to retire, you'll have a nest egg. This is just a quicker path to the same place that you say you want to go. Then we need to focus people on the fact this is the same system with a new asset. We need to be teaching this as a get-rich-slow methodology, meaning that if I earn more money than you and we both take the same approach, I'm probably going to do better than you with it. If we're both doing 5% of our income and I make $125 a year and you make $65 a year, I'm going to get ahead of you really quick. It's okay. Your choice is either to participate or not, but it is the same formula. It is the same formula that if you're like my age, like a guy that was 50 here, right? Desert Ranger, right? When we were 25 and the financial liar came into our offices to brief us on our new 401k plan, it's this: put 10% minimum of your income into your retirement. We're just saying save that money in Bitcoin, or save a portion of that money in Bitcoin. Save the majority of that money in Bitcoin. But what I've seen from young people who get into Bitcoin, and this is very encouraging, is once they buy it, they don't want to sell it. They don't want to get rid of it. So much so that we have Maxi shrieking, we need to spend it. You know, we do not have a problem with too little spending in this country of any form of money. What we lack is enough investment and savings and long-term resiliency. And Bitcoin makes people want to hold on to their wealth forever. And that is a sea change that is one of the most important things Bitcoin has done. It might be more important than just wrenching economics out of the hands of government. I mean, that's incredibly important. But because it did that, and because of the way in which it did that, the net effect that's the biggest effect is that once people become Bitcoiners, real Bitcoiners, seasoned Bitcoiners, they think like wealthy people before they are wealthy. Wealthy people follow the advice in George Clason's book that when you earn money, a portion of it is yours to keep, right? That tenth you put away is yours to keep. The rest you can spend on like a house, food, and fun, and a car, and everything else. But a portion is yours to keep. And once you keep it, it gets locked away, and then it should make more for you. It should have children, and its children should have grandchildren, and its grandchildren should have great-grandchildren of your original money you put aside. And you should treat it like a slave. You never let it go. You leverage it. You put it to work for you, but you never let it go. You never spend it. You never sell it. You keep it. When you tell somebody this, when they're 21 years old and they could most benefit from it, their general response is, I can't afford it. No matter what they say, it's some version of I can't afford it. And what they really don't understand is they can't afford not to, but they go ahead and not do it anyway. It is only by, unless you're born into money or win a lottery or something like that, it's only by adopting the mindset of the wealthy that you become wealthy. You have to think like the wealthy before you are the wealthy. Bitcoin is making people think like the wealthy. And the work Michael Saylor added to that of talking about how you can leverage your Bitcoin and borrow against a portion of it for the rest of your life in retirement and never sell your assets, that was the whole formula the wealthy used for centuries, and we weren't supposed to know. It's changed the mindset, and that's the most important thing. Now, my final thoughts here. Back to Harvard. Harvard in 2018. Bitcoin is more likely to go to $100 than $100,000. And my God, if you don't think that had an effect, especially on boomers, Harvard said that, especially like financial manager, even if they didn't go to Harvard, even, you know, they went to like, you know, Texas Tech or something, I don't know, like just a good school, Ohio State or whatever, but, you know, not an Ivy League, they still looked at Harvard. Harvard says that. I ain't putting my money in that shit. That's for you young idiots, right? That's what they said in 2018. Flash forward to this year. Harvard buys $117 million of Bitcoin at $118,000 a coin, $18,000 a coin more than they said it could ever hit. More likely to go 100. What does this tell us? Stop giving me your bullshit about if I would have known, because no, you wouldn't, because now you know and now you're not. In the end, there's a fundamental reality here. Everybody gets Bitcoin at the price they deserve, including me. So yeah, I bought some Bitcoin at $600, and I bought Bitcoin today at $118,000. And because I didn't buy more then, I have to buy more now, so I am paying the price I deserve, which is higher than I could have paid. That's what Harvard did. What's funny is until just now, I owned a lot more Bitcoin than Harvard did, you know. But now they own a lot more than me because I definitely do not have $117 million worth. But that's a pissant amount, really, when you think about it, compared to what we're talking about coming. This is all coming. There's no way around it. Again, I built this morning, I guess you'd call it a report or a brief or whatever. It's 12-page full analysis on all of this. Here it is right here. You know, it starts off with an executive summary, key findings, everything you could want to know. Here's the sources. That's the sources cited. That's how many sources went into this. Now, again, I didn't write this. I couldn't have written. I could write this. I couldn't write it in a morning, right? Even starting to show an hour later, I couldn't have gotten this done by myself. I spent 30 minutes dragging all of my notes together, having a deep discussion with Google Gemini. I'm trialing Gemini, even though I've been mostly a GPT user. I'm seeing some differences, some things I like about Gemini, some things I really like about GPT, like custom agents. Can't do that with Gemini. Can't do that with GPT. Crit method works with GPT, doesn't work with Gemini. But the deep think function in Gemini, once you set the stage for what you want to know about, it generates these. I mean, this is something you could turn over to an investor. You know, I mean, breaking down the individual entities in a table and what their primary motivation is. I mean, this is pretty badass bit of work, if I don't say so myself, even if AI did a lot of the actual labor of it. But it took my knowledge, all this stuff that I've pulled in over the last year as I've looked at this unfolding and making sure it knew what to look for, knew what I was going at, knew what my angles were, sanity checking whether I made sense. And I said, okay, now make me the report. Here it is. It's in a PDF. There's a link in the video notes below. When we're done with the live, you click on it. You don't have to fill out a form. You don't have to give me your email. All you got to do is look up the notes. And the last bullet point says, get my free 12-page full analysis report on this topic. Click it, and it's yours. It's free. It's not even a lead magnet. You can just have it. I do not believe in the secreting of knowledge. And this was pretty easy to put together. And it was pretty justified or pretty gratifying for me to see that when I pointed this thing at facts and said, now you pull it together, you tell me what's going on, that it actually came to pretty much the same conclusion I did, but it's actually more positive. It's more favorable than I was. I think we're onto something here, guys. I think, you know, I remember Hal Finney of Bitcoin fame, who left us way too early in life, said something like, you might want to pick some up in case it catches on. I think Satoshi said the same thing. Maybe you would want to pick some up today because it might catch on even more than it already has. With that, let's take a couple of questions and then we'll wrap up. Jacarivius says, at what amount of Bitcoin should I get into a second wallet? Bro, that is your own choice. You know, you have to decide how many wallets you want, how much you want to mitigate that. You know, some people might say it's $500,000. Some people might say if you have $500,000, you should have 5 wallets. You know, I mean, some people would say, you know, 25 grand. I mean, I can't tell you that. All I know is that each wallet is very secure, but yet has its own individual risk. And so I would definitely say you probably, once you get up into like, you know, a few tens of thousands of dollars, need to look at more of like the percentage of your total. For people that buy a lot and invest a lot, another really cool strategy is, because it makes it very easy if you do liquidate to know what you're liquidating, is get a new hardware wallet every year and then move your Bitcoin onto that hardware wallet. If you don't buy that much, maybe you do that every 2 years. So you would know, like, all the Bitcoin on this wallet has a cost basis that's the aggregate average of 2024 and 2025. And then in 2026, you buy another wallet. This is something every person must decide for themselves. But definitely you want to be using a hardware wallet if you self-custody. Cold Card, Trezor, whatever. Something good and well thought of in the industry. Texas Plant Company, do you think banks will custody and cover with FDIC insurance? I don't know if they'll put FDIC insurance on it. They shouldn't have to, because if it's custodied, one Bitcoin equals one Bitcoin, but they may eventually consider your Bitcoin deposits equal to your cash deposits and your total deposits subject to FDIC insurance. I don't know, but by the very way they're being done, stable coins will be under FDIC, which is exactly what I said would happen. Mick says, how do you do well with Bitcoin? A, buy it. I don't know if that's really a question. I think what he's saying is, if you want to do well with Bitcoin, just buy some. And I think that's pretty good advice. Anyway, with that, let's go ahead and wrap things up. I want to remind you guys, one of the ways you can help support my show is to buy my book, Laws of Life. If you've ever wondered, how does Jack know all this stuff and how has Jack managed to do so much in his 53 years? It is the things in this book and Laws of Life 2 that I'm working on right now, another 16 laws. This book is not what to do, because only you can decide that. This book is how to think about life and how life works and the consequences of actions or inaction and how to approach that. And when I say laws in this book, I mean laws like the law of gravity. You drop shit, it falls. It is. It's just the way it is. It's the way things work. There's things here about human interaction, and it's the way people work. There's things here about money, and it's the way money works. There's things here about experience. It's the way that experience over time works. That's what laws of life is. If you want to know how a guy went from coming to Texas after he got out of the Army, driving a $400 car, to making a six-figure income within 4 years with no college, with no certifications, with no nothing, starting from literally absolute bottom of the barrel, packing boxes in a warehouse to a six-figure income in 4 years, it doesn't tell you how I did it, little bits of and pieces of it, but it tells you what I, how I approached it, how I made it happen. This is a great book for that young person in your life, too, who needs a little bit of a kick in the ass to realize the opportunity that is ahead of you right now. Next up today is do your online shopping at tspaz.com, T-S-P-A-Z, tspaz.com. Now, yesterday, I showed you this little new folding scalpel. Today, I actually got the review done for you. This is a little bit bigger than the one from last week. I have the review up. It's made by a company called Bulletins. This guy uses a number 60 surgical blade. They're very inexpensive. You can buy it. Because Bulletins was smart, what they did is they tied into an existing supply chain. So since every hospital, every medical facility, et cetera, uses every veterinarian, et cetera, uses surgical blades, they sell them in great big packages instead of some kind of proprietary blade. The one that I showed you guys last week has the number 25. That's a small blade, deep belly. And the number 60 is a lot more like a pocket knife. And it's even got a clip for a pocket knife, one hand open. I've got a full video review now and everything on the site. If you click on the link in the video notes below, you can get over to the audio side and find all the cool stuff today. The free report, the reviews of the cool stuff on T-Spaz and all the other stuff that we provide, including three great resources to help you stack those sats, because you can still stack sats not just by buying Bitcoin, but by using certain things like the Fold card. So you can learn all about that with that link down there in the video notes. With that, I'll catch you guys tomorrow. We're back on mushrooms tomorrow, yeah? We're not going to just stick to like the Bitcoin. This is not a Bitcoin show. It's a lifestyle design show. That's what the Survival Podcast really is. That's why we talk about preparedness and growing your own food and alternative energy and all the other things too, because we're designing a resilient lifestyle. And feeding ourselves is a great way to do that. So I have a gentleman coming on tomorrow named Kevin, and he's going to talk about specifically growing mushrooms indoors in small spaces. And I think that will be a lot of fun. Then we'll have our expert council show for the week, and we'll do it all again next week. Take care, guys. I'll catch you tomorrow. Just run you round. They said you should have a house the American way. $1 down, $1 a month, and you never have to pay. Show you a better way. You don't have to be another face in the crowd. You don't have to live the way they tell you to. Make your own way, others will follow. Revolution.